Good morning. My name is Jessica Sievers. I am secretary for the board, and I welcome you to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan on the day before the first day of spring. I'm so excited about it. I have a little welcome here in the words of Erica Hewitt. It's called "Put Away the Pressures of the World," kind of fit into our risk theme for March. As we enter into worship, put away the pressures of the world that ask us to perform, to take up masks, to put on brave fronts. Silence the voices that ask you to be perfect. This is a community of compassion and welcome. Do not be afraid to risk being who you are and showing your full self. You do not have to do anything to earn the love contained within these walls. You do not have to be braver, smarter, stronger, better than you are in this moment to belong here with us. You only have to bring the gift of your body, no matter how able, your seeking mind, no matter how busy, your animal heart, no matter how broken. Bring all that you are and all that you love to this hour together. Let us worship together. We invite visitors and guests to sign our guest book at the welcome table in the narthex out in the hall. On that form, you can request a complimentary subscription to our newsletter. Before we begin the service, we have a few announcements. And first, I'll draw your attention to those in the bulletin. To kick off our April theme for transformation, instead of doing one central reflection, we're going to have Reverend Jonalu answer your questions. So we'd like to have those questions from you no later than Friday, March 31st. You can email them at the addresses listed, or there's a box outside at the narthex that you can leave at the end of the day. Also, our annual meeting is April 23rd, following the service. We'll be voting on a few important things. And then Harriet has an announcement.
Usually I think of this after we have changed the hangings and put these, taken down the winter and put up the spring things. But these banners were created by the women of the congregation several years ago. The vines represent the unity of our fellowship, that we're all connected, and the leaves represent each individual. There are plenty of leaves that do not have signatures on. And I have special pens. Don't use your fountain pen. It may bleed. I'll lay these out on the back table, or the table in the LSOP room. And I hope that anybody that has not signed it will take one of these pens, write slowly so the ink has time to get into the fabric, write slowly and put your name on a leaf. That way we have any friend or member is welcome to sign it. A lot of you have already done this, and it's really interesting to look through and see members that have gone on to other places or have passed away. And I hope you will all sign this.
Thank you, Harriet. Those are so beautiful. Justin Harms will do our chalice lighting. Let me not pray to be sheltered from dangers, but to be fearless in facing them. Let me not beg for the stilling of my pain, but for the heart to conquer it. Let me not look for allies in life's battlefield, but to my own strength. Let me not crave an anxious fear to be saved, but hope for the patience to win my freedom. Grant me that I may not be a coward, feeling your mercy in my success alone. But let me find the grasp of your hand in my future, in my failure. Please rise in body or spirit and join in singing hymn number 168, One More Step. Now let us share our joys and sorrows. Regard your neighbor's gain as your gain, and your neighbor's loss as your loss. Please raise your hand for the microphone.
Good morning, Austin and Carrie Roberts. We have both a joy and a sorrow this morning. First, it was a joy to see so many of you at our baby shower yesterday, and it means an awful lot to us to be part of this community. So thank you.
The sorrow is that my mom could not be there yesterday because she has spent most of the last week up in Michigan sitting with my grandfather under hospice care. We don't know how long he has, but it's probably days. So.
This message is on behalf of Sybil, who's somewhere in the building. Yesterday, Dave Lambert celebrated his 25th birthday, and there will be birthday cake for him in the coffee hour. So everybody stop by and say, "Happy birthday, Dave!"
Did I hear you right? 25th? Okay.
I'm Grace McMillan, and my husband and I just celebrated our 10th wedding anniversary on Friday, St. Patrick's Day, so that was really nice, and he's not here, he's usually not here, but he actually is in Costa Rica for the next 9 days, so it was really nice to celebrate that, but I'm really going to miss him again, but I get these kids for spring break, so that's nice.
Hello, my name is Jess Finkmeyer. I recently auditioned for a part in the school play called Rehearsal for Murder, and I got a part, so I'm super excited about that. We've already started rehearsals, and we're like halfway through the entire thing, so yay.
I'm Jane Pelletier. I'd like to just recognize Christopher Renner, who's working so hard on all of the Indivisible Manhattan efforts to influence government. Many ways to say that. So thank you, Christopher. You represent us well.
And I also would like, I'm Susan Adamchak, and I'd also just like to acknowledge that the UUs were well represented in the St. Patrick's Day parade yesterday. There was a very large contingent that marched with March, Women March Manhattan, Women for Kansas, and the Indivisible Manhattan. There were probably about 40 or 50 in that group, I'm not sure. There were a few blocks where we got just a few stares as we walked by, and there were many more blocks where we got a lot of applause and friendly waves.
Michael Oldfather, and since nobody else is doing it, I want to be sure that former members Jim and Barbara Bascom are visiting here from Washington, and Jim properly genuflected before me, and I helped him get up.
I'm Harriet Yonke, and I have to admit that sometimes my UU kind of sits around and I don't get it read completely. But this one, my gosh, if you haven't looked at the spring issue, this article, Be a Patriot, it's really scary. I mean, you think the news is scary. They're suggesting solutions for us in here, what to do when the worst comes. So take a look at it. There's some other articles that are really good.
Larry Weaver, I had a joy yesterday. I was sitting in Blue Stem Cafeteria. There were, after those, or maybe during those races in Aggieville, and I saw several couples, including a very young baby, like 2 months, something like that. And they were playing with the baby. They were doing wonderful things. The baby was happy. The parents were doing just great things with the baby. And I was saving a seat at a table, so I didn't get up and walk over and tell them that. And they left before I was able to. But I thought back on my own life. It's so easy for me to remember the times that I screwed up as a parent. I remember those times, and I wanted to say something to those people so that maybe they would remember this time that they did it right, even though maybe they remember the times that they screwed up. So parents, remember that you've done an awful lot right.
We honor those joys and sorrows shared here today. For those left unspoken, we hold you in our hearts. So next, it's time for our story of all ages. I'll be reading a book. If those children and children young at heart want to come up to the front and join me. Good morning, good morning, good morning. All right. Do you guys have, like, cabin fever yet? Can you feel it? Feel like you're ready to get out there and spread your wings? No? Okay. Well, this book is called If I Never, Forever, Endeavor. And endeavor, does anybody know what that means? Yep, to take a chance and explore. So this is about a little bird. If in all of forever I never endeavor to fly, I won't know if I can. I won't know if I can't. I won't know if or whether a flight I might fly should I choose to not even give it a try. On the one wing, I could try and find that I flap and I fail, flounder and plummet, look foolish and fail. On the other wing, I could try and take flight, rise high and float free, sail through the trees. If I did endeavor and found my wings clever, I could see the world. Or get lost in it. My nest is so nice, the nicest of nests. Who needs to fly? Ever. I think I'll forget all about this endeavor. But look there, if I didn't fly, I won't know what it is to swoop low or soar high, or what it's like to pluck a sweet bug from the sky. I won't know how it feels to scallop the air with a dip and a glide, or float alongside a friend. Sigh. I suppose I could try a little flap, a flutter, or two. Flutter, thwack, thud, thump, flap, flutter, flap, flap. Fly. Look at me, I'm dipping and gliding and daring and flying. If I hadn't endeavored and found my wings clever, I never a sky would have scaled, never a world would have seen, and never a friend would have found. Friends of a feather, I say, endeavor and fly. So go to your RE classes and take some risks.
Oh, we love our hearts so deep.
Our stewardship testimonial this morning is from Grace McMillan.
I appreciate the timing of this so that I didn't have, I was telling the kids on the way here, like, you might have to just sit down while I have to go and talk about something. So I should have looked at the order and realized you had it planned. So my name is Grace McMillan, and I've been a member of this fellowship for, I think, a little more than 3 years. I found Unitarian Universalism 10 years ago when I was newly pregnant with Liam and getting ready to marry my husband. We joined the UU Fellowship of Topeka just a few months after finding it, after our first visit. And that's when we were first introduced to the ideas of giving our time, talents, and treasure. Back then, I had time. I had so much time. I had more time than anything else on that list, so that's what I gave the most of. I led committees, I organized events, I prepared food, I just showed up, but we still gave our treasure, even though it wasn't much. At that time, I thought of it kind of like my donation to NPR, like, well, if everyone just gives a little bit, you know, it'll be good. And my giving was really based by what I was getting out of my community. I was getting support and guidance and new ideas, new ways to take action. I pledged to my community what I could give, and it was probably like $5 a month. But to me, I was like, I'm giving in all these other ways. And I knew that even that little bit was still important. Later, my pledges evolved. I was able to give a little more, and it was based on supporting not just what I got back from my community, but what my children were being given. So by the time we arrived here in this lovely community, I didn't have time to give. I barely have time to show up on Sundays. I'm in grad school, and my kids are bigger, and I can't give in the same ways I was used to giving before. So I gave, and I was able to increase my pledge. So like different stages of my life, I've been able to give back to these communities that give me so much. Still, I pledge every year, and I know that this monthly gift makes a difference when combined with everyone else's. But today my gift is less about what I get back or even what my children receive from this community. Today my treasure is given to sustain us as a whole and to hopefully influence the community beyond these walls. I'm grateful for all the years I've had this faith and the different ways I've been able to give and to receive. As my family looks to the future with plans to trek once again across Kansas, we're still prepared to pledge and give to this community, even when it won't directly benefit us anymore. The work we do here is too important, and I'm grateful I've been able to be a part of it. Thank you.
The offering is a sign and symbol of our uniting together. Because we offer to this fellowship our time, treasure, and talent, we are able to do more together than we could ever do alone. In that spirit, we now receive our offering. Thank you, Renee. In preparing for this service for January's Martin Luther King Day that got snowed out, I was really intrigued by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from Birmingham Jail. So I've taken some excerpts, which look like a lot of excerpts, and I want to give John Alou some time, so I'm going to kind of go through it fast, but there's some really good points in here. Oh, okay. It's in 14 font and 4 pages, but okay. So this was written by Martin Luther King Jr., August 1963, from Birmingham Jail, where he was imprisoned as a participant in nonviolent demonstrations against segregation. He wrote in longhand the letter which follows. It was his response to a public statement of concern and caution issued by 8 white religious leaders of the South. It sounds a little choppy. That's where I've taken out some things, because he was a wonderful writer and orator. While confined here in the Birmingham City Jail, I came across your recent statement calling our present activities unwise and untimely. Our local affiliate here in Birmingham invited us to be on call to engage in nonviolent direct action program if such were deemed necessary. We readily consented, and then the hour came when we lived up to our promises. So I am here, along with several members of my staff, because we were invited here. I'm in Birmingham because injustice is here. I cannot sit idly by in Atlanta and not be concerned about what happens in Birmingham. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all. Indirectly. You deplore the demonstrations that are presently taking place in Birmingham, but I am sorry that your statement did not express a similar concern for those conditions that brought the demonstrations into being. It is even more unfortunate that the white power structure of this city left the Negro community with no other alternative. In any nonviolent campaign, there are four basic steps. Collection of the facts to determine whether injustices are alive, negotiation, self-purification, and direct action. We have gone through all of these steps in Birmingham. Birmingham is probably the most thoroughly segregated city in the United States. The political leaders consistently refuse to engage in good faith negotiation. In these negotiating sessions, certain promises were made by the merchants, such as the promise to remove the humiliating racial signs from the stores for whites only. The signs remained. We started having workshops on nonviolence and repeatedly asked ourselves the questions: are you able to accept blows without retaliation? And are you able to endure the ordeals of jail? You may well ask, why direct action? Why sit-ins, marches, and so forth? Isn't negotiation a better path? You are exactly right in your call for negotiation. Indeed, this is the purpose of direct action. Nonviolent direct action seeks to create such a crisis and establish such creative tension that a community has to consistently refuse to negotiate, is forced to confront the issue. Some have asked, why don't you give the new administration time to act? My friends, I must say to you that we have not made a single gain in civil rights without determined legal and nonviolent pressure. History is a long and tragic story of the fact that privileged groups seldom give up their privileges voluntarily. Individuals may see the moral light and morality Individuals may see the moral light and voluntarily give up their unjust posture, but groups are more immoral than individuals. We know through painful experience that freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed. For years now, I have heard the word wait. It rings in the ear of every Negro with a piercing familiarity. This wait has almost always meant never. Justice too long delayed is justice denied. And still we creep at horse and buggy pace toward the gaining of a cup of coffee at a lunch counter. I guess it is easy for those who have never felt the stinging darts of segregation to say, wait. When you see the vast majority of your 20 million Negro brothers smothering in an airtight cage of poverty in the midst of an affluent society, when you suddenly find your tongue twisted and your speech stammering as you seek to explain to your six-year-old daughter why she cannot go to the public amusement park that has just been advertised on television, and see the tears welling up in her little eyes when she's told that Funtown is closed to colored children, and see the depressing clouds of inferiority begin to form in her little mental sky, and see her begin to distort her little personality by unconsciously developing a bitterness toward white people. When you have to concoct an answer for a five-year-old son asking in agonizing pathos, "Daddy, why do white people treat colored people so mean?" When you are harried by day and haunted by night by the fact that you are a Negro, living constantly at tiptoe stance, never knowing what to expect next, and plagued with inner fears and outer resentments. When you are forever fighting a degenerating sense of nobodiness, then you will understand why we find it difficult to wait. I have almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's great stumbling block in the stride toward freedom is the white moderate who is more devoted to order than justice, who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice, who constantly says, I agree with you in the goal you seek, but I can't agree with your methods of direct action. Who paternalistically feels that he can set the timetable for another man's freedom, who lives by the myth of time, and who constantly advises the Negro to wait until a more convenient season. Shallow misunderstanding from people of goodwill is more frustrating than absolute misunderstanding from people of ill will. Lukewarm acceptance is much more bewildering than outright rejection. It is the strangely irrational notion that there is something in the very flow of time that will inevitably cure all ills. Actually, time is neutral. It can be used either destructively or constructively. Oppressed people cannot remain oppressed forever. The Negro has many pent-up resentments and latent frustrations. He has to get them out. So let him march sometime. Let him have his prayer pilgrimages to the city hall. Understand why we must have sit-ins and freedom rides. I've tried to say that this is normal and healthy discontent that can be channeled through the creative outlet of nonviolent direct action. Was not Abraham Lincoln an extremist? This nation cannot survive half slave and half free. Was not Thomas Jefferson an extremist? We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. So the question is not whether we will be extremist, but what kind of extremists we will be. Will we be extremists for hate, or will we be extremists for love? Will we be extremists for the preservation of injustice, or will we be extremists for the cause of justice? I am thankful, however, that some of our white brothers have grasped the meaning of this social revolution and committed themselves to it. They are still all too small in quantity, but they are big in quality. They, unlike many of their moderate brothers, have recognized the urgency of the moment and sensed the need for powerful action anecdotes to combat the disease of segregation. Over the last 5 years, I have consistently preached that nonviolence demands that the means we use must be as pure as the ends we seek. I have tried to make it clear that it is wrong to use immoral means to attain moral ends. But now I must affirm that it is just as wrong, or even more, to use moral means to preserve immoral ends. One day the South will recognize its real heroes. They will be old, oppressed, battered Negro women, symbolized in the 72-year-old woman of Montgomery, Alabama, who rose up with a sense of dignity and with her people decided not to ride the segregated buses and responded to one who inquired about her tiredness with ungrammatical profundity. My feet is tired, but my soul is rested. They will be the young high school and college students, young ministers of the gospel, and a host of their elders, courageously and nonviolently sitting in at the lunch counters and willingly going to jail for conscience' sake. One day the South will know that when these disinherited children of God sat down at lunch counters, they were in reality standing up for the best in the American dream and the most sacred values. Yours for the cause of peace and brotherhood, Martin Luther King, Jr. Stand as you're able, body or spirit. Hymn 106, Who Would True Valor See?
Watch the show Black-ish. For those who don't, the program features a contemporary upper-class black family, an advertising executive and doctor, their four children and assorted relatives. And in the episode the week prior to Martin Luther King Day, the oldest son, Junior, was supposed to recite the I Have a Dream speech at his exclusive public high school, at his exclusive private high school. And his grandfather, who describes himself as an angry black man, tells him to read the rest of the speech. And after he does, Junior shows up in a black turtleneck and beret, radicalized. Funny, but we get the point. Now, this reflection was originally supposed to take place Martin Luther King weekend, and in some ways, it's probably good to do it another time, because it really isn't good to contain the Martin Luther King message one weekend a year, nor is it good to pay attention to racial justice issues one weekend a year. So I thought, why not in March when we're talking about risk? And risk is really an appropriate theme for that time when King was writing from the Birmingham jail. And I think it provides a useful model, too, for us in these times to look at what Martin Luther King had to say. He was a lot more radical than many people would like for him to have been. And when we celebrate him, we often undermine much of his message by neutralizing it, making it fit for public consumption. All God's children are one. Fine. But the implications of that in real life are staggering. When we look at our culture, based as it is in hierarchies of individuals, with some still having advantages, others don't. I grew up in Virginia while Dr. King was still alive, and I know how nervous he made white people I knew, including my own family. People were content with how it was. White people were content with how it was. And I can assure you that those people who I've heard say recently that race relations have never been worse do not remember the South in the 1960s. Racial tensions were high and they stalked everyone, white, black, and other people of color everywhere, schools, movie theaters, government, churches. Our contemporary notion of Dr. King as a great leader who everyone listened to fails to capture the real controversy that he stirred. We, too, often depict him as a leader who people loved and supported even while people worried about the radicals like the Black Panthers and Malcolm X. And that's not how it was. Dr. King has been domesticated. Here's what African-American UU theologian William Jones had to say. He wrote, "I have a nagging suspicion that white America desires to perpetuate a black hero who fits its special needs of oppression and not those of black liberation." Oh, it's okay. Jones says white adoration of King secures him more as a guardian of white interest than as a black Moses to lead his people to freedom. So, that was certainly not the case when King wrote his letter from Birmingham jail, a letter that continues to ring true for me. So, some historical background. Step back into an historical moment, one of the crucial times and documents of the civil rights movement, the writing of that letter from Birmingham jail, parts of which we heard read this morning. In April of 1963, civil rights advocates had rallied to pressure the white leadership of Birmingham, Alabama, to end racial segregation. Using nonviolent direct action, including boycotts, sit-ins, and marches, African Americans and their allies, organized by the Alabama Christian Movement for Human Rights and the Southern Christian Leadership Council, SCLC, had a list of demands. They wanted equality in hiring practices and desegregation of the downtown stores. Plus, the city had closed the city parks because there was an order for desegregation that they were evading, and the agitators wanted parks to reopen and to be integrated. And they sought the creation of a commission to oversee school desegregation. Now, this is 1963, so that was after the Brown versus Board of Education ruling. Schools were still not desegregated. So they had these clear goals, and the larger purpose of the action was to demand a place at the table for African Americans. The times were tumultuous, especially in Birmingham, where the Commissioner of Public Safety, Eugene Bull Connor, adamantly and even violently opposed any change to the white structures of power and privilege. City government defied court orders and election results to assert segregationist principles. And though the famous 16th Street Church bombing didn't happen until a few months later, Birmingham already had a well-deserved reputation for violence and racial antagonism. So, 1963. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was not yet as broadly known as he is today, yet known enough to receive frequent criticism. He had not yet delivered his masterful I Have a Dream speech on the Washington Mall or received the Nobel Peace Prize, but was already under investigation by the FBI. A 34-year-old pastor serving Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, the church his father had served, King had already forged strategies in the well-known Montgomery bus boycott and in an unsuccessful push for desegregation in Albany, Georgia. Now, how many of you have heard of the Albany Movement for Civil Rights? Two, of course, because it failed, or at least it won too little at far too great a cost. including divisiveness within the movement. That Albany failure shaped the work in Birmingham as much as anything else did. King learned from that failure that rather than a diffuse attack against segregation in general, it helped to have clear, specific targets with intense focus. And frankly, it helped to have police who were more aggressive against demonstrators rather than the skillful disruption by Albany Police Chief Laurie Pritchard, who arrested people gently rather than violently and dispersed prisoners throughout the region rather than having an overflowing jail. So in Albany, things just didn't look as bad. The optics, as they say, were not as bad. King's involvement with the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the SCLC, brought him into both Albany and Birmingham. The SCLC was founded in 1957 in the wake of the Montgomery bus boycott and controversially encouraged church activism in opposition to segregation. Now remember, it wasn't only white people who didn't like the tactic of church involvement. There were African American pastors who thought the church should stay out of it. And there were the usual power struggles present within every movement. King would preside over the SCLC, though, until his assassination in 1968. But, so here we are in Birmingham. Good Friday, April 12th, 1963. King, along with other marchers, was arrested in Birmingham for violating a court order against all forms of protest. Note that. There was a court order against all forms of protest. Sounds to me contrary to the First Amendment, but there you go. That was what it was like then. Later on the day of King's arrest, Good Friday, remember when Christian clergy are notoriously busy, the Birmingham News published a so-called call to unity, an open letter by white clergy, which acknowledged the problem of segregation, but argued that the proper forum for its resolution was the courts, not the streets. The very courts, I suppose, that had said that all forms of protest were illegal. The authors criticized the direct nonviolent actions as premature and asserted that in due time, change would come. They went so far as to name Martin Luther King Jr. as an outside agitator. King began his response, which came to be known as the letter from Birmingham Jail, in the margins of a newspaper that was smuggled to him in his cell, a newspaper that included this call to unity. And quickly he realized that his audience was much larger than the eight clergymen who had written the call to unity, and that his message needed to be heard across the country. And the response, cobbled onto whatever pieces of paper he could acquire, ran more than 10 times the length of the 7-paragraph call to unity that his antagonists had written. Originally, the New York Times Magazine expressed interest in publication, but they reneged on that. This was controversial stuff. However, the Christian Century and the Atlantic Monthly both published it before the summer was out, and excerpts of it cropped up in a lot of places. King himself included it in his book, Why We Can't Wait, the following year. The use of the letter echoes the letters of the biblical Paul, who wrote some of his work from jail as well. But letter from Birmingham Jail is far more than an epistle. It's an essay, a treatise, a defense, a sermon. The epistolary frame of it creates a clear pro and con structure that focuses on the tension and the context. King begins his letter explaining that he seldom addresses criticism because he receives so much of it. But he wants to address these sincere, good-willed clergy. The white writers of the call to unity serve as a foil. They're representing the many good white people who recognize injustice but fear rapid change and social unrest. King is writing to all these people rather than to just the Call to Unity authors. And it's really important that this is not a letter that was written to his African-American followers or even white allies who agree to the work. It was really directed toward white moderates. And that's clear from where it was published. Magazines whose audiences were mostly white and often specifically Christian. King challenges the assumption that he is an outsider, first by explaining his organization and how they were invited in, and then as a religious man fighting injustice. He underlines the connections to biblical themes in his reference to the Apostle Paul, as well as to earlier prophets. King is, after all, a minister, and acting as a minister in his justice work. Through the SCLC, he had dramatically named the need for religious action to end segregation. And throughout the letter, religion rings the call for justice. His message is not just a call for freedom. It is a gospel of freedom, as he names it himself. Yet there's more. King weaves some of his most famous words in this section, describing the interconnection among all. And though these words are focused here on describing the connection between people from different cities working on the same issues of desegregation, the implications run deeper, reminding us that not only do blacks from Atlanta and Birmingham share concerns, but indeed all Americans of all races affect one another. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. King addresses his white colleagues' concerns about the demonstrations, which do not take any account of the conditions that brought about the actions. He then explains the process of a nonviolent campaign and what has taken place in Birmingham. Throughout the letter, he addresses the clergy directly, sometimes even citing their political arguments. You may well ask, he says, so that he can spell out the full case. And particularly, he answers the criticism that the marches are untimely, that they didn't give the new city administration a chance to respond to concerns. Now, King's words here that freedom must be demanded by the oppressed echo Frederick Douglass's from a previous century. Power concedes nothing without a demand. The oppressed must assert their need for freedom or it will not be recognized, much less given. King rejects unequivocally the call to wait and draws on a familiar quotation often attributed to Prime Minister William Gladstone, equating the delay of justice to its denial. And in the remainder of the letter, King elaborates with vivid illustrations and examples. Then he moves to a consideration of just and unjust laws, concluding that there is a duty to break unjust laws. He answers the complaint about his extremism, positioning himself between those who advocate accommodation to segregation, and those who advocate violence, and finally embraces the label of extremist for love, extremism for love. And in strong terms, King expresses his disappointment in white moderates, particularly in the church, though he extols some specific white allies, indirectly urging those he addresses to join their cause. And finally, he objects to the commendation of the police that his antagonists included in their letter, reminding his readers that it is wrong to use moral means to preserve immoral ends. Rather, he suggested, it's the black protesters who need to be commended. King apologizes for the length of his letter, but asks directly, What else can one do when he is alone in a narrow jail cell other than write long letters, think long thoughts, and pray long prayers? In closing, King expresses the desire to meet his readers as Christian clergy and brothers. Throughout the letter, King uses a direct and personal style, yet his rhetoric soars. His use of biblical imagery reminds us of his ministerial background, while his quotations and allusions reveal his acquaintance with legal and historic scholarship. The letter endures as a memento of a dramatic moment in American history and as an inspiring example of the religious call to action. What does it have to say to us today? First, I'm reminded that the times we are in today, where lines are drawn and curses cast, are more like the times of Martin Luther King than any time we have seen since. Today, we have some of the clarity of the 1960s and 70s, though as in those times, the opposition comes in various shades. For all the Bull Connors who attack those working for racial justice with vehemence and violence, there are a lot more Laurie Pritchetts. Remember the police chief from Albany, Georgia? He still arrested the protesters, but didn't confront them with barking dogs or beat them with sticks. And while we might prefer being arrested the gentler way, it makes the whole incident easier to ignore for those not directly involved. And ignorance of the circumstances may be the real opponent. A couple months ago in the UU world, not this issue, but the one before that, there were paintings by Brittany Leanne Williams. Did anybody see those? They're really powerful pictures, I think. It's white picnickers enjoy a beautiful summer day, while in the background shadows looms an abused African-American strung up and left for dead. And at first, when you look at the picture, you don't necessarily see that person in the background, but once you do, you can't unsee it. And I think that is what is often true of circumstances of injustice, that they can kind of blend into the background, but once you see them, you cannot unsee them. The white clergymen who wrote the letter that King responded to were not bad people. They themselves would never have beaten protesters or sicked dogs on them. They knew segregation was wrong. They knew a transition was necessary. But they were the people of whom Frederick Douglass wrote when he said, "Those who profess to favor freedom and yet deprecate agitation are people who want crops without plowing up the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the awful roar of its waters. The struggle may be a moral one, or it may be both moral and physical, but it must be a struggle." And then that sentence I quoted earlier that rings through King's writings, "Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did and never will." The white clergymen in Birmingham were wrong because they did not fully grasp the situation before them. Though they knew there was discontent, they didn't see the figure hanging from the tree. They didn't acknowledge the real pain that they were helping to perpetuate. And they did not acknowledge or embrace the power that they had to make change. I learned long ago in dealing with oppression, if you're not part of the solution, you really are part of the problem. Wait is not the right answer to injustice. Not that strategy doesn't matter. One of the lessons that King brought from Albany to Birmingham was that strategy matters. Clear, focused actions tied to clear, focused demands, ways to achieve small wins that can lead to more organizing that leads to larger wins, paying attention to the context and what may work today. Not that we always know that, but to the best of our abilities. King explains in his letter some of the basics of community organizing strategy. What he called collection of facts, I'd call research. And then negotiation, he talked about. We negotiate with those in power. And a seat at the table is what we're always striving for in organizing, an opportunity to negotiate. And next, King says, comes self-purification, which is an interesting term. I call it education, except it's deeper than simply learning things. It's knowing in your body how to act. King made sure that people knew how to respond nonviolently in whatever situation they encountered, strengthening themselves as individuals and as an organization. They prepared for that action systematically and collectively. And this approach, this four-part thing, still works for us today. We dig into the research to be sure we know the realities. You don't want to go into it not knowing your facts. The realities of people's lives, people's stories, and who has the power to make the change and how. Then the second thing, we negotiate, unless and until we are barred from the table. Third, we educate ourselves and one another and learn in our bodies how to take action. And then fourth, direct action. So yes, strategy matters. We have to think it through and carry it out, and we are called on to do this in today's climate. The final lesson that I take from King's letter, and so much of his work, is his ability to place it in a larger theological context. Remember, he talks about a gospel of freedom and contextualizes the struggle in the Christian tradition. While we may not draw from all the same sources he does, the idea that we need to situate our fight for justice in our theological truth remains. It's the workshop I gave in February in Lawrence on building the beloved community. We need to respond to a higher call, a moral call, when we're doing prophetic work, and use that moral language. That's one of the lessons that... I just lost his name. Reverend Barber teaches us. Thank you. So again, we may not share all King's theological groundings, but we do share some. In particular, these grand statements of global truths from the letter. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. And those ideas are as true today as ever. And that's why we can't ignore racial inequality in policing. That's why we can't ignore persecution and suspicion of Muslims and, for that matter, Jews who are receiving threats, Sikhs and Hindus who are caught up in things. And that's why we can't allow mass deportations of immigrants that disrupt families and workplaces. And that's why we have to ensure adequate health care and mental health care for everyone. And that's why we can't ignore the suicides, homicides, and accidents perpetuated by the ubiquity of guns in our society. And that's why we have to be responsible enough to slow rather than accelerate climate change. One issue after another, the reason we have to pay attention and address them is because we are tied in a single garment of destiny. What happens to you affects me. This is profound, challenging theology. We are not fundamentally separate individuals. We are one at the deepest level. This matters. And if you hear the rhetoric from the right about individualism, you'll see how that is theologically wrong. We must remember, though, that King did not end racial injustice, much less attain the ideals of freedom and peace that he strove for. His life cut short before the goals were achieved. We have no excuse to sit back and let be the circumstances that he would have fought against. That's why we have to look to where we are today, what tasks are before us, and who can help us along the way. So I'll leave you with words that King wrote in the 1960s that are still true today. We do not have much time. The revolutionary spirit is already worldwide. If the anger of the peoples of the world at the injustice of things is to be channeled into a revolution of love and creativity, we must begin now to work urgently with all the peoples to shape a new world. So may it be. Our closing hymn is known popularly as the African American National Anthem. And we join our hearts in being allies with justice as we sing, as we rise and sing the closing hymn number 149. Lift every voice and sing.
Lift every voice and sing till earth and heaven ring, ring with the heart.
God of our ears, God of our sight.
Take courage, friends. The way is often hard. The path is never clear. And the stakes are very high. Take courage, for deep down there is another truth. You are not alone.